Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland, made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Kat Johnson kicked the season off with an episode about food and football, so now we're turning to one of my favorite sports, talking about cookbooks. We'll take a sneak peek at a few recipe breakthroughs that Rose Levy Barenbaum discovered while working on her 12th cookbook.
You know, so this was such a eureka thing. People ask me if I still keep learning. And yeah, just thinking about it and trying to find a better way. It happens.
And hear about the challenges of writing a book about alcohol from HRN host Souther Teague.
The history of drinking is very blurry. Because people were drinking and no one was taking notes.
Plus, we'll get all the expert dish about the most exciting cookbook titles heading to bookstores this fall.
Like jazz music, it's been a part of American cuisine for centuries.
Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts and be the first to know when the next episode drops.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. The North American Free Trade Association, or NAFTA, has very much been in the news lately, with the pending renegotiation of the trade agreement close to being finalized. So I could think of no better time to talk about the lessons learned from the past 25 years of this agreement, with a special focus on food, this being a food policy show and all. Joining me today in the studio is author Alicia Galvez, professor of Latin American and Latino Studies at Lehman College of the City University of New York. She's also the author of the new book, Eating NAFTA, Trade, Food Policies, and the Destruction of Mexico, which looks at how free trade policies have affected food production, traditional culture, and the collective health of the American people. Alicia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, Jenna.
Okay, the title of your book, The Destruction of Mexico. It's a pretty bold statement.
A little polemical, but yeah. I think in a lot of ways, that's what we're talking about. We're mm-hmm. talking about the destruction of a kind of lifestyle in Mexico that lasted for millennia and has really been under threat in unprecedented ways in the last 25 years.
All from the United States in just a matter of two or so decades.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's, just stepping back, can you tell us a little bit about your background and why and when you decided to write this book?
Yeah, so I am not the person you would think of. I'm not a usual suspect to write a food policy or trade analysis. I am a cultural anthropologist, and I came to this topic by way of studying Mexican migration for two decades. I have done my field work here in New York, looking at the waves of Mexican migrants, mostly from the state of Puebla. Mm-hmm. And then I've done a lot of research and spent a lot of time and made a lot of friends in Puebla and surrounding states that have sent so many migrants to New York. And it was that led me to be really, well, I love eating. I mean,
yes, obviously.
I'm sure that we share that with all of the listeners.
Yes.
And I love nothing more than sitting at someone's table and hearing about their life and watching them cook and helping them cook and eating what comes of it. And I was able to see over time how the way people eat has changed a lot, often as a product of the change in the economy that has driven many families to be separate from one another. Mm-hmm. It has changed people's health because of the
types of
availability,
food.
The types of food, the availability of highly processed foods. And so many of my friends' family members have gotten sick and many have passed away from diet-related illness, so much that it's shocking. Mm-hmm. One of the towns that I know the best is a rural community, and if you walk down the street there, people will say, you know, every second person here has diabetes.
Well, yeah. I mean, you
cite some really shocking statistics in your book, but I just have to ask real quick, cultural anthropologist, can you just explain kind of what that is for somebody who might not know?
Yeah, so no dinosaurs, no fossils.
Yes, yes.
contrary to popular belief, unlike Indiana Jones, we work with living communities. And so cultural anthropology is really looking at the ways that people live their lives. It's everything from material culture, like food and you know, things that people make and do, but also symbolic culture, as well as the meanings that people make, the way that they communicate with each other, family structures. And I came to see that NAFTA was really disrupting all of these aspects of life. And so I didn't necessarily want to write a book about a trade deal, but it was so...
you didn't find that it's not why you wake up every morning to talk about trade deals?
But I came to see that it was having such an incredible impact on the lives of people that I know and who I've known for many, many years that I had to have a better understanding of it.
And so let's talk about some of those repercussions or, you know, the effects. So, but before we do, I want to kind of go back to basics, you know, just laying out all the things we're going to be talking about in this episode. And so, you know, can you tell us in very broad strokes what NAFTA originally proposed to do?
Right.
And then we'll, you know, talk about kind of, you know, just in general, the trade agreement.
Right.
Very broad strokes. And then we'll talk about, like, in theory, what was the intention?
Yeah. So there's the hidden story and then there's the official story. So the official story, if you go on YouTube and watch the speech that Bill Clinton gave on the day of NAFTA's inauguration, he talks about mutual prosperity and how the U.S. was going to, U.S. businesses were going to see, you know, this incredibly increased territory in which they could operate, and that that would lead to mutual prosperity. That was the official branded version of NAFTA after it was signed. But we have to go back a lot sooner than that to see how NAFTA was built. And NAFTA was built, it was the brainchild of very wealthy investors, both U.S. and Mexican investors, who were concerned that Mexico was going to, the then president was concerned with protecting Mexico from globalization. And they were concerned that that would mean that they would not be able to do business. And so they started to first paint that president as being a little bit crazy and unstable and incapable of making decisions.
Because he was protectionist.
And then they started to circulate the idea of a free trade agreement in North America. And this is something that was really very popular among the Harvard-trained economists that came to constitute the cabinet of the next president, Carlos Salinas Gortari, who today is, you know, just considered a nemesis of the Mexican people. People in Mexico almost universally hate him.
Wow.
And he, in the late 80s, thought that, you know, Mexico would... He believed that Mexico's prosperity would come from outside investment, and so he thought that would come from Europe. And Europe shrugged its shoulders and didn't really care about doing a deal with Mexico. And the U.S. said, well, we would do something. And then Canada eventually joined the deal as well. But there wasn't a lot of interest on the part of the U.S. The U.S. didn't think that Mexico's economy was big enough to really matter.
Right.
And so the U.S. Said, you know, you're going to do things, but you're going to do it according to our terms. And that was where we see the beginning of the bullying of the U.S. towards Mexico with this deal, and very specific things that were built into it to benefit the U.S. over Mexico's interests. So the biggest example of that is that we see that the U.S. made it a non-starter to talk about migration.
Yeah. What does that mean? I mean, what do you mean talk about migration? So
yeah.
to prevent migration?
Well, Mexico thought, you know, if we're going to do a deal with our North American neighbors, then they sort of had a vision, like the European Union, that there would be a, you know, kind of a breaking down of all the barriers.
Okay.
Right.
Okay,
so that goods, capital, and people would be able to flow freely amongst the signatory countries. And the U.S. said, yeah, that's nice. We'll do goods and capital, but not people.
Okay.
And that was just from the start. So Mexico sort of had this vision of a three-legged stool. But the United States took off one leg right away. So the whole deal has sort of been wonky since then.
So what would that have done, though, if it was more like the European Union? What were the benefits of that kind of three-legged proposal have been?
Well, we wouldn't be talking about immigration as a problem today. Mm-hmm. The incredible militarization of the border, the dehumanization of migrants, the detention and deportation of millions of people, family separation, all of these things are product of a criminalization of the flow of people.
Which ironically spiked, right?
After the
deal went into effect?
Yes. Yeah.
And so, in terms of like the labor force, though, so, you know, what would that have meant?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in some ways it's hard to even know, right? Like we can't necessarily go back in time or look in our crystal ball. But I would imagine that we would have seen a more sane and humane flow and circularity of people, because mm-hmm. my experience with Mexican migration over many years is that I've met very few people who actually ever wanted to migrate. People migrate because
it's very contrary to a popular American belief that everyone's clamoring to get into the United States.
It's a myth. Most people, you know, some people say there's, you know, the American dream and then there's the Mexican dream. And the Mexican dream often includes doing, you know, some years of work with the higher wages in the United States that are available, even in the lowest paid sectors. Mm-hmm. You know, a farm worker makes 10 times as much in the United States as a farm worker in Mexico.
Wow.
So you're going to see people.
And they are notoriously underpaid.
Low paid.
Yeah, to
right?
say.
The worst say that, yeah. paid mm-hmm. sectors in the United States.
Like they cannot find other, you know, people to fill those roles.
Exactly. And so people are going to, you know, no wall is going to stop someone from, you know, finding those jobs if they're available and they pay so highly. What used to happen before we militarized the border after 9/11 and in the, you know, the late 90s, even before 9/11, is that people would come and go seasonally. They would come and go with contractions and expansions of the economy. They mm-hmm. would come and go as the U.S. demanded more workers. And what we ended up doing was basically imprisoning people who wanted to be temporary migrants in the U.S. because the risk and the cost of coming to the United States is so high that right. people don't risk that circularity anymore. So instead of going back and forth, they come and then as soon as they can, they bring more family members and they settle here semi-permanently, which a lot of people don't want to do.
Right.
If they wish to, I happen to believe they should be able to.
Right.
It should be safe and available for them to migrate permanently. I don't think that there's any moral superiority to someone who's an engineer and wants to be a permanent resident over someone who has any other kind of role in our economy. But a lot of people don't actively wish to stay here forever. They certainly don't actively wish to be locked in the United States mm-hmm. and separated from families by this immigration.
Right.
And you write context.
You write in the book about you know, a particular family mm-hmm. that came to the United States and, you know, worked and then eventually saved money and moved back to Mexico mm-hmm. and opened up a kind of grocery store, right?
Yeah, a lot of people seek to do that. They seek to open a small business.
Yeah.
To buy, you know, build and live in a home after they retire mm-hmm. As soon as they've saved enough. And so I start the book with a story of a family that's done that.
So, you know, migration. Okay, so kind of getting back, we digress in the most wonderful and interesting
it's easy
ways.
To do that. Yeah.
So migration, that was sort of taken off the table at the very beginning, and the trade deal you said was kind of, you know, inherently skewed. What else did it propose, and then
right
look like, you know, in actuality?
Right. So Mexico really. Had this vision, again, based on foreign direct investment being its pathway to prosperity. And the way that they saw that was through really industrial sectors of the economy. They wanted to industrialize their economy. They wanted to move people out of the countryside into these new modern, quote unquote, sectors and jobs.
Mm-hmm. Like urbanization.
Yes. So urbanization and just shifting of sectors. So even, not even, you know, just to the capital, but all, you know, kind of this proliferation all over Mexico of these industrial zones. That was the vision. And part of that vision, they acknowledged as collateral damage the possibility that 500,000 peasants would be displaced, mm-hmm. because this was literally a campaign for de-peasantization. They saw this as the necessary precursor to the kind of prosperity that they thought would bring them into the future. What they didn't anticipate, so they thought 500,000 would be displaced. Mm-hmm. It was 500,000 per year for the first 15 years of the trade deal. So it was many times the magnitude that they ever anticipated. And the amount of pain that was caused continues till this day of just people being very abruptly unable to make a living off the land in the ways that they used to do.
Mm-hmm. And you, I think it seems like you argue throughout the book, and one of the things you state is that, I mean, obviously the idea is that Mexicans would be better off with the trade deal. It's pretty clear, but now 20.5 million more Americans are poor than Mexicans. That's as of 2000. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, Mexicans, are poor. Than in, you know, from 2014 from 1994 to 2014.
Yes.
So which seems very ironic.
In the first 20 years. Yeah. We really have not seen the poverty numbers budge. And in fact, I was sitting at the, you know, at the desk of one of the architects of Mexico's anti-poverty policy in the federal government. And he said, we need to acknowledge that we haven't moved the needle on poverty in the last two decades. Mm-hmm. This is really frightening because that was the purpose of NAFTA. The purpose of the pain was this future prosperity. And instead, you know, if you look at the rest of Latin America, the countries that didn't have a trade deal, poverty has dropped double digits, close to 20% on average in the rest of Latin America. So the fact that Mexico still has this really persistently high poverty rate really shows us that the trade deal has failed at delivering what it was supposed to deliver. Mm-hmm. There are lots of new billionaires in Mexico.
Bonus.
And they, you know, are quite happy with the deal, and they'll do a lot, you know, a lot. They'll go really out of their way to make sure that it gets, you know, that it's perpetuated into the future. But that doesn't benefit the vast majority of people.
So what are some of the other repercussions? I mean, it seems like, so was the agreement successful in encouraging a large part of the population to move towards the, like, auto and, you know, manufacturing kind of sectors? Was that successful?
So those industries have exploded. Mexico is now a hotbed for car production, for aeronautics, for all kinds of industrial production. You see plants for Audi and for Volkswagen and other companies. You see, you know, entire aeronautics industries, a lot of components, things that go into the products that we, you know, buy in the U.S. consumer tech goods oftentimes have components that are produced in Mexico. And one of the things that NAFTA favors is piecemeal manufacturing, mm-hmm. so that, you know, one plant will produce one tiny little piece of a larger set of components. So we have seen that. The thing is that, like the United States, a lot of these jobs are trending towards automation. Robots are doing a lot more of the work. There is work for people with engineering degrees, and Mexico is getting pretty good at educating people with engineering degrees, and mm-hmm. they can find work at the highest echelons of these industries. But that remains, like here, a relatively small percentage of the population.
Right.
And so there's a lot of people who aren't finding a new place in the economy. And, you know, like we saw in the 2016 presidential campaigns, there are scapegoats, right? So in the United States, we saw both Trump and Bernie Sanders talking about NAFTA being a bad deal for U.S. workers. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of arguments that can be made about that. But the way that Trump framed it was that Mexico was winning at the U.S.'s expense. Yeah. And if you ask the average Mexican, they don't feel like winners. The average person, just like here, feels like they're scrambling and hustling harder than ever before to stay in the same place.
Yeah.
The bottom has fallen out of their you know, their lifestyle, their ability to provide for their families, everything is increasingly precarious. And so people are really disadvantaged in both countries. And that was the, you know, one of the main reasons why I was interested in writing this book, because mm-hmm. I don't think that we see ourselves in the United States often enough as having way more in common with the average person in Mexico than we do differences yeah. and common cause.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So what are the, you know, to talk specifically about kind of food production.
Yeah.
What have the repercussions been over the past couple of decades on food production in Mexico specifically and in the U.S.?
Yeah. So there have been sort of contrary trends. So in the United States, because of NAFTA, we have more access than ever before to a lot of really delicious stuff. Mm-hmm. Our avocados, our limes, chiles, peppers, cucumbers, tomatoes, mangoes are coming from Mexico. So year round here in New York City, we can eat all of those, you know, delicious foods with no, you know, worries that it might be the middle of winter. In Mexico, paradoxically, it's been the opposite. So Mexico has seen a decline in the quality of the average person's diet. People are eating less fruits and vegetables, and they're eating about 20% fewer tortillas, which is the main staple of the Mexican diet going back thousands of years.
Which seems to be the thing that you kind of use as the... Mm-hmm. Canary in the
coal. Yeah.
That's a sort of way.
It's so emblematic.
Yes,
it's just
yes.
so central to the story because, you know, Mexico was the subject of a genocidal conquest by the Spanish, but they kept their tortillas.
Right.
It was subject to wave after wave of, you know, kind of plans for industrialization, plans to mechanize tortilla production and mechanize corn production. And none of these things really diminished the centrality of and the ubiquity of tortillas in mm-hmm. the average person's diet until NAFTA. And now yeah. we see this really dramatic shift away from the milpa. Milpa is the field that is where corn is grown in small-scale farming.
Okay.
Corn and beans and chilies and squash are intercropped.
Okay.
And so the soil is replenished, the nutrients, the micronutrients of the soil are replenished.
How food is supposed to be produced,
exactly.
essentially.
It's yeah. sustainable. It can go on forever and ever, basically. You don't require, you know, a whole lot of equipment. The corn,
pesticides.
Which might, you don't need pesticides. Mm-hmm. The corn, which might blow over if it were by itself, is held up literally by the beans, mm-hmm. you know, intertwining around it. So we see this incredible system for producing this main food crop. But the milpa-based diet is constituting less and less and less of a proportion of people's everyday foods. And instead, we see people consuming a hugely increased amount of ultra-processed foods. So Mexico, sadly, is now number one consumer in the world of instant noodles, to give one example.
Which seems so bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for given kind of their food traditions.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
It's really tragic. I mean, we're talking about one of the greatest cuisines in the world.
So there's no demand for like exporting of Mexican corn, or is just like a flood on the Mexican market
yeah.
of US cheap corn and
so and thank goodness this is a food policy podcast because I think your listeners might be nerdy enough to care along
100%
with me
yes.
about this. So there is a problem with that equivalency in terms of how we think about corn. So the deal, the kind of the devil's bargain mm-hmm. with NAFTA was the idea of comparative advantage. And comparative advantage is an idea in economics that if one place can do something better and more efficiently than another place, then that place should do all of that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other places should specialize in what they're good at, and then everybody can just buy each other's goods. So under the logic of comparative efficiency, the United States, because it's number one in yield of corn, Iowa corn fields produce, I think it's 10 tons per hectare of corn. And in Mexico, it's about 1.8. Nowhere else in the world comes anywhere near Iowa. China is number two, but it's still, you know, vastly smaller yields than the United States. The United States has figured out how to grow, you know, industrial corn in larger quantities.
Yeah, we're really good at that.
Ever in world history.
But not necessarily corn for human production, though.
Bingo. So the thing with it is that we grow corn in the United States that's been genetically modified, and, you know, the amount of technology that goes into getting that yield is, you know, shocking. I mean, we know about this from, you know, everything from Michael Pollan's books to, you know, the documentary King Corn. You can see just the incredible investment that yield requires between chemicals and pesticides and genetically modified seeds and million-dollar tractors and corn subsidies and consolidated farms that are super flat so that you can get your million-dollar tractor up and down the rows of corn. All of these things go into producing that super high yield. Mexican corn, the heirloom varieties of corn, and there's dozens of them historically, were micro-adapted to very specific eco-niches. So, you know, this side of the hill might have one variety of corn that was better for the sunny side of the slope, and on the other side of the slope that gets more rain, it might be another, you know, slightly different varietal of corn.
Biodiversity,
yeah. Very irregular, you know, the small scale farms are very irregular plot sizes. There's no tractor that's going to get in there to help them. They do everything by hand. It's a very small yield, but guess what? They are spending often nothing.
Right.
No pesticides.
Yeah, they don't feed
necessarily.
Into, like,
some people do use, you know, some herbicides, some pesticides, but historically, obviously none. No tractors, sometimes not even an animal to help. No irrigation.
That seems not great for, like, U.S. corporations.
No, there's no money to be made.
Right.
And guess how people get their seeds? They save them from 1 year to the next. Well, obviously Monsanto, you know, is not interested
in that,
right?
Yeah.
Because they are patenting seeds with certain properties, and so they make them sterile. So, in other words, you know, the yield of Mexican corn is small, but the inputs are small. So one of the things that I point out in the book is that I think that this is a really problematic understanding of efficiency. I think we've gotten efficiency wrong. I don't think that the U.S. should be growing all the corn for everybody, because we grow it in such an intensive, tech-intensive, capital-intensive,
unsustainable,
environmentally unsustainable way. And so, yeah, it's cheap and plentiful, but what are, you know, at what cost, really? So because of that devil's bargain, where Mexico decided they didn't need to grow corn anymore in order to be prosperous, they needed to make Volkswagens and buy their corn on the global market from the U.S., we see this diminishment in the small scale subsistence farm. We see this diminishment in the centrality of corn tortillas. And we see this flood, which was, you know, not instantaneous because there were certain protections, but they almost, you know, they were kind of jumped over and avoided and pushed out of the way very rapidly. This flood of, you know, U.S. GMO industrial corn into Mexico. And you know, and your listeners know, that most of the corn growing in Iowa can't be eaten. Mm-hmm. It's not our sweet corn that we eat on the cob in August and September. It's, you know, it's starchy. It's made for feeding animals. It's made for making corn syrup and corn starch and ethanol. So it's not for making tortillas or tamales. So just because there's suddenly more cheap corn doesn't mean that people are actually able to eat in the way that they used to eat.
Okay, we're going to have to take a really quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors, but stay tuned.
All right.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of the Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kaltbach Cave Age cheeses, Der Scharfer Max, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Okay, and we're back on Eating Matters, where today we're talking all about NAFTA with author Alicia Galvez, who recently penned the book Eating NAFTA, Trade, Food Policies, and the Destruction of Mexico. Okay, so I want to shift and talk about one of the other kind of main repercussions of this trade agreement, and that is obesity and diet-related disease.
Yeah.
So one of the statistics that you said in the book was that 71.3% of the population, the Mexican population, is classified as overweight, which I think is actually slightly higher than yeah. U.S., which is shocking.
Yeah.
I didn't even know. I really thought that we took the cake in that.
Yeah, we did. And then Mexico usurped the number one spot. And now, sadly, actually, Chile has usurped Mexico.
Wow.
Which, by the way, has, you know, a very intertwined trade environment with the U.S. And so it's for a lot of the same reasons.
Right.
It's the, you know, ultra-processed food environment and this transformation of lifestyles that is really, you know, exposing us to this cocktail of, you know, very toxic products made with toxic chemicals and really distancing us from, you know, the kinds of things that used to sustain health and well-being.
Mm-hmm. What is the role in soda? Yeah.
Well,
you know, like, what are some examples of those yeah. of those kinds of products that we see? I mean, I'm assuming they're like
yeah.
Like you said, cheap processed food.
Yeah. So Mexico is number one consumer also in the world of soda. Soda plays a big role in the average person's consumption. Part of the reason is that Mexico has a very underdeveloped water system. So a lot of people are unable to access free potable water through their faucets. And so when people go to buy all of the things that they need to, you know, stay alive and not be dehydrated, they actually are presented with option, you know, lots of options in bottles, including soda being often priced cheaper than bottled water.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this incredible really craven profit seeking on the part of a lot of the corporations, in the sense that by the same measure that soda has come to be understood to be kind of universally unhealthy in the United States and in a lot of places, we've seen this dip in consumption on the basis of consumer awareness.
Mm-hmm.
The soda companies, instead of kind of saying, you know, our bad, we'll,
yeah.
we'll stop making this, you
That's
know, poisonous
happen.
Product,
yeah.
they double down in other parts of the world, hoping to sell as much soda as they can to compensate for the decline in some other countries like the U.S. And also because they anticipate the big tobacco moment when it's going to become undeniable and they're actually going to be held accountable for the health consequences of their products.
Yeah.
And until then, they're going to sell all the soda they can. So Mexico has actually been quite forward-thinking in terms of passing a soda tax at
right.
the federal level to try to diminish soda consumption.
Which was huge.
Huge.
I mean, they did that well before any state or locality was able to do that.
Exactly.
In the United States.
And like here, the soda companies did everything they could to block it and
right.
to stop it. They sat at the bargaining table. They, you know, got their hands into, you know, got whispered in the ears of legislators. There was even allegations that the New York Times exposed about 2 years ago in December about spyware being used to spy on nutritional
Probably.
Advocates.
Yeah.
It's kind of shocking. You don't think of dietitians and nutritionists being the subject of, you know, spying, but
I mean, you do if it's like a multi-billion dollar
industry. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. And so, what we've seen, you know, one of the, I get a little bit into the, you know, the weeds in my analysis in the book.
That's good on this show.
Yeah.
We like that.
Yeah. Because I actually, even though it is very progressive and radical on the global stage, I actually point out the ways that a lot of people in Mexico, a lot of the nutrition advocates say that actually the soda companies were able to really dull the soda tax and make it, you know, about half as effective as it should have been, both in terms of how big it is. It's 1 peso per liter, and the mathematical modeling said it should have been 2 pesos per liter to actually have the desired effect on consumption. Mm-hmm. But also because, you know, there are things like the proceeds from the soda tax are supposed to go to providing potable water in every public school in Mexico. And I think 2% of public schools, you know, after 2 years have water available to their students, drinking water. So we're seeing just a lot of, worrisome aspects. And one of the aspects that I get into the most is the way that I think a lot of these policies are actually premised on a notion of everyday people, average citizens being culpable for their health problems. And so there's something about diet-related illness that even people who experience these things tend to blame themselves. If only I were more disciplined, if only I exercised more, if only I didn't have such a sweet tooth, I would be healthy. And what I came to realize is that one, you know, public health and epidemiologists, research shows pretty convincingly that it's structural factors more than anything else, more than behavior, more than individual choices that determine diet-related illness.
And what are some examples of some of those structural changes?
So income levels, access, you know, housing.
Education,
employment precarity, trauma, exposure to violence, family separation, exposure to chemicals. Mexico has a very high rate of kidney disease that's been associated with some of the chemicals used in agriculture. So a lot of these things are really assaulting metabolically the human body in ways that are sort of unprecedented in human history. And the fact that the body responds, you know, there have been studies, for example, on mice. You know, I don't want to get into too much of the detail because we could be here all day. But, you know, there have been studies on mice that, you know, exposure to certain chemicals leads to weight gain, even though calorie consumption is reduced. And so a lot of these chemicals that people are being exposed to are known obesogenics. And so, but the thing with the personal behavior hypothesis is that it allows the government and the corporations to wash their hands and say, you know, let's put in a park or put in a bike lane or put in a walking trail in an urban area, and we've done our part. We don't need to worry about these larger structural issues. Right. And if people are sick, it's their own choice. It's their own problem or lack of discipline. And I think this is a real problem of our understandings of citizenship, because if we're blaming people for this epidemic that's so closely, you know, it's too coincidental with NAFTA in the last 25 years, this unprecedented spike. You know, people didn't develop a sweet tooth in the last 25 years.
Right.
People didn't suddenly become, you know, couch potatoes in the last 25 years. In fact, a lot of the people who are suffering from these illnesses are people who have, you know, such strenuous commutes and work lives. It just defies logic. And yet we see this very handy alibi for bad policy.
Do you think that this kind of trend in the Mexican diet was inevitable with the broader movement towards globalization and opening of borders to free trade? Or do you think this is something kind of unique to this particular trade agreement?
Yeah, I mean, there are people like Corinna Hawkes in the UK who have found that globalization comes with diet-related illness.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again, globally, we see, you know, these two hand in hand.
Is that just, you know, trade policies with the United States, or is that more broad?
Broadly.
Kind of, yeah.
You know, there's a public health scholar in South Africa who's noted how some of the companies peddling ultra-processed, you know, super high sugar foods, packaged foods in South Africa are actually South African corporations. It's not necessarily U.S. corporations, but it is a model of economic development that really emerged out of neoliberalism, out of U.S. financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, that really privileged foreign direct investment over the kinds of investment that governments historically had into the health and well-being of their countries, right? So cutting funding on public health care, cutting funding on education, cutting funding on all kinds of things that, you know, food distribution systems, for example, that used to help balance out some of the inequalities that people faced.
Poverty fighting measures.
Exactly.
One thing, and we have to unfortunately wrap up soon, even though I wish I could talk to you all day long. I want to talk about something that you point to in the book, which is as Mexican traditional foods have been made available, more available, and are kind of seen, especially in the States, as like high value status foods that are like elevated and reinterpreted by global elite chefs. The flip side of that is that, Mexicans are eating, right, like the more, like they can't kind of afford the sort of food that's been championed by like elite foodies,
absolutely,
to put that in quotations. So I wonder if you can, and it seems like, the part about that where Mexicans can't afford the most like basic sort of the way that they've eaten for generations is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
No question about that. I wonder if you kind of see the flip side of that where Mexican cuisine is sort of being elevated and celebrated by like a different group of people as a bad thing.
It's not, I can't say it's a bad thing. I love it. I love getting hand ground corn tortillas in New York City.
Right.
When I moved here from California to go to college many years ago, you couldn't get tortillas to save your life in New York City. I love that this wonderful cuisine is finally getting respect in the global sphere. I love that, Top Chef and, all of these, Rene Redzepi, who's arguably one of the best chefs in the world, says that tortillas are the perfect food. I think this is wonderful. I think it's overdue recognition of this incredible millennial cuisine. The problem is that when people like Rene Redzepi, who I think really sees himself as paying homage to the humble cuisine of the milpa, when he does it, he is also profiting by it, right? So he had a pop-up in Tulum last year.
I remember, yeah.
He sold out 6 months in advance tickets for dinner in this pop-up restaurant before it existed at $600 a head, right? Plus another $150 in taxes and fees. Those resources, I'm not even sure they went through Mexico. They probably went through the cloud to a Danish bank. He did do a lot of things to hire local people and, as he said, to transfer some of the wealth. But there's a little bit of a plundering happening in terms of, some people getting really, able to charge really high prices in this sort of elite food world that's very cosmopolitan. At the same time that people can't eat this way for whom that was their food, right. Originally. And there's something about narrative capital. There's something about storytelling that is enabling some people to profit wildly. And I think there are two sides of the same coin. I think one thing is actually made possible by the other thing. I think that if, working people in Mexico were still eating, you could still walk down any street in Mexico and have mind-blowing, tacos in the same way, or people in their homes were growing corn and chiles and squash and able to make it in the same way they always did, I don't think anybody could get away with charging these, astronomical prices for these products. So I think that these are two things that go together.
I mean, and that kind of leads me to my second question, which is as a cultural, and this I really sort of struggle with understanding this, like as a cultural anthropologist, what crosses the line between like the celebration and integration of a certain culture's traditions, into American society, you know, what, where does the line get crossed between like celebration and then it becomes cultural appropriation?
Right. I think we need to,
and like, what is that term, you know, yeah, it really kind
it's of complicated. Mean? And I think sometimes it gets used as sort of a weapon where people get accused of cultural appropriation, you know, as a kind of call out, that doesn't have a lot of substance. But I think what ends up happening, I think when we should be concerned is when we see the object being separated from its people, right? So when the people for whom this is their tradition, mm-hmm, are absent or invisible or silent, and somebody else is kind of taking their thing and making a lot of money off of it, I think that's when we can call cultural appropriation for what it is. You know, I think there are ways to be collaborative and there are ways to elevate and amplify the voices of those who to whom this is their culture, going back thousands of years, you know, the communities in Mexico that have developed this cuisine, and find ways to use our technology and our networks and social media to shed a light rather than, you know, turn our the spotlight onto people like Red Zepi, who certainly already have plenty of attention.
That is true. Okay, very, very last question before we have to wrap up. And, you know, I want to just to quote Bill Clinton in 1993, he says, quote, "We cannot stop global change. We cannot repeal international economic competition that is everywhere. We can only harness the energy to our benefit." I'm wondering, you know, it seems to me that we can't quite at this point turn back the tide of 25 years of globalization. So what do you propose to do? And, you know, specifically, yeah, what would you like to see from this renegotiation of this trade agreement?
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, this moment puts me in a strange spot because we have a president precisely who is trying to throw the brakes on,
yep,
globalization. But I think we all see that that's a little bit reckless and not really realistic, right? There's a lot of pain that would be caused by somehow trying to sever these ties that are at this point quite well developed. I think for me, what I would like to see is a greater, you know, in the interest of social justice, in the interest of greater equality and less inequality, I would like to see more people at the table so that we in the United States and people in Mexico come to see each other as having a lot more in common than we have differences and common cause, so that these deals can't be done in the dark and, you know, behind closed doors without including our interests. The interests of working people, of consumers, need to be elevated over the interests of corporations. And I think that basic equation of who's, you know, who's benefiting by these things, is it corporate profits or is it the general population? If we can push that and say that we need deals that are sustaining of health and the earth and, mm-hmm, our well-being and bring us closer together rather than further apart, that would be my goal.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. I loved talking with you. And just quickly, where can listeners find your book?
Amazon, any store. The UC Press has a coupon discount, I believe, right now that the book is coming out. It can be ordered directly from the press.
All right, wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you again for coming on the show. Big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support, as well as to our engineer, the one and only Matt Patterson, the best engineer on the face of the planet. Show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.